Hello, and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph. I'm Artemis Irvin, and in today's episode, we're travelling back to the year 1825 to witness the Regency in all its glory. The Regency, or Georgian England, is one of the most loved periods in British history. It was a period of transition that reflected unprecedented social, economic, and political change. But it was also the age of Jane Austen and Lord Byron, the paintings of Constable, and the sartorial elegance of Beau Brummel, a time of famous military victories and revolutionary fervour. Its fashions, interiors, and architecture still have their power to captivate in a way that no other era quite matches. Many see it as a last age of true freedom, Merry England's final dance before the Victorians arrive to turn the music off. To explore this fascinating world, John Hillman met the Sunday Times best-selling author of the Time Traveller's Guide series, Ian Mortimer, for a tour of the Regency's concert halls, stately homes, and new industrial beginnings.
Okay, hi, Ian, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, good. It's lovely to have you here. Lovely to have you. The Time Traveller's Guide to Regency Britain, published by Random House. Congratulations.
Thank you kindly.
This is your fourth in the series.
This is the fourth Time Traveller's Guide, yes. Right. It's really pushing me to the extreme of what I feel comfortable with, because, as you probably know, I'm by training an early modernist, 16th, 17th yes. century, and most of my books have been medieval. Evil, which is probably where I feel most comfortable. So,
right.
In stretching the medieval all the way through to about 1830, I'm really pushing it.
Brilliant. Was it part of the plan to get to Regency Britain?
Yes and no. I mean, the idea was, yes, it was always part of the plan that would be at least four books.
Right.
And the whole theme is... It works in various ways. Time Traveller's Guides are really accessible books, really easy to enjoy and loads of detail, blah, blah, blah. But also they work by allowing us to juxtapose now the traveller, us, in the modern world, and people in the past. And the big theme, which was introduced in the first book, is that it's actually a derivation on something W.H. Auden said. Auden said, in order to understand your own country, you need to have lived in at least two others. And I thought about that. I reckoned, well, to come to terms with your own time and understand the time in which you live, you really need to have come to terms with at least two others. And so what I thought I'd do was start at the beginning of my period of expertise in the 14th century and then work through to as far as I could get. So the first three were easy. I mean, relatively easy. Medieval, Elizabethan, Restoration, period of my PhD. And then we came to the Regency, and how do you eat an elephant? It's a massive subject.
It is a massive subject. And just for our listeners, just before we get going, can we just establish the dates we're talking about for them?
Okay. The official Regency is the years that Prince George stood in for his ailing father, George III, and ruled as Prince Regent, which are 1811 to 1820. However, most cultural commentators recognise that the period that represents is much more valuable if it's seen as a longer term, which is not dictated by the Prince's Regency itself, but by the period between his first being proposed at regent, which coincides with the French Revolution, 1789, and ends with his death in 1830, which is right on the cusp of reform in this country. George IV stood in the way of reform.
Right.
So it has political as well as cultural relevance and much more meaning when you look at 1789 through to 1830.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned this in your book, that the period begins in 1789. And you also mentioned that this is the same date as the French Revolution. And I wanted to ask you about that, because something that I found was quite interesting is the way you are, the influence that the French Revolution actually had on this period in Britain.
Yeah, it's such colossal. I mean, the more I've looked into this over the last 3.5 years, 4 years, the more I've really been staggered by how influential in every walk of modern life the French Revolution is. I mean, there's the standard joke of the Premier of China in 1968 being asked about the effects of the French Revolution, making a mistake and thought they were talking about the 1968 revolution and said it's too soon to tell what the effects would be. And everybody presumed he was talking about 1789, and this was some sign of great Chinese foresight, that it was still too soon to tell what the effects of the French Revolution of 1789 were. But in some ways, he is actually right, because so many aspects of life come back to that event, both in terms of turning around thousands of years of the way that humanity had organised itself, certainly in Europe. An aristocracy supporting an absolute monarch would actually govern in their own interests, to a country being governed in the interests of the mass of its people. That's one major start. All that radicalism and reform really is unleashed by the French Revolution. Mm. But then so many other aspects of man's role in society, women's role in society. Up until the French Revolution, every men who have high status dressed in ways that would show off how wealthy they were and how powerful, and in some periods showing how little they needed to do for themselves by wearing clothes that were totally impractical. And yet then, 1789, if you're a man of action, you need to show it through what you do and what you say, and your clothes should reflect that. And you know, even things like the National Gallery are down to the French Revolution. Mm. The French revolutionaries took over Louis XVI's art collection and the Louvre and opened them up as a gallery for all the French people. And there you have the British in the first couple of decades of the 19th century priding themselves on being aristocratic and noble and nothing like those hoi polloi in Paris.
Right. Yeah.
And we hadn't got a National Gallery, so why not? You know, so many aspects. I mean, I constantly find things that surprise me about this.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating a period, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about four decades where, you know, I think you mentioned it yourself. We today, and when you walk around Britain today, I know we have listeners all over the world, but, you know, it's still the case, isn't it, that the best of a lot of what is the best of British architecture, best of British, the most desirable streets in London, the most desirable towns, these are still very much Regency towns, Regency streets. It's a fascinating fact. I mean,
yeah,
in fact, this brings me on to another question I wanted to ask you, actually. I mean, you write about in this period, it's really caused you to question more so than any others, the idea that we should judge historical individuals according to the values and standards that they themselves recognize.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I mean, what is it about this period in particular that makes you question that kind of established convention?
This has been a growing surprise, and this is one of the biggest things I have learned over the whole 25 years I've been writing time travelers' guides and juxtaposing present and past. Because I started off as your standard academic background, although I was an archivist initially as well, so I qualified as an archivist. And archivists and academic historians reminded repeatedly through our educational processes that if you want to understand the past, you mustn't look at people in the past through the eyes of the present. You mustn't look at businessmen from the 16th, 17th centuries through our eyes and say how ruthless or cruel they were, because by the standards of their own time, they weren't these things. And it's something I've employed regularly in talking about, for example, medieval cleanliness or Elizabethan cleanliness. You can't judge their standards of cleanliness by our standards of what we think is clean. Otherwise, we might be considered dirty by the standards of the future. And we don't think of ourselves as dirty. So in this sense, you need to judge everything and everybody by the standards of its own time. But then you have things which you feel are imbalanced. And I think it comes clearest across in slavery, because there you look at the great businessmen of Liverpool, etc., in the 18th century, not only packing slaves into ships and basically making a fortune out of the utter misery and humiliation of fellow human beings, but priding themselves on it and people putting statues up to them, etc. And this seems wholly wrong. And I mean, quite apart from the Black Lives Matter movement, which has brought a lot of this to the fore, it is, I think, against a sense of eternal justice. And that sense of justice goes right back to slavery in the ancient world, where to be honest, slavery could be even worse because a slave owner had dominion, absolute authority, absolute power over everything he owned, and had the right to be cruel and torture and kill people if he wanted, his slaves, this is. Now, if they knew it was wrong then, and they did, they had a guilty conscience about slavery, then surely down the ages we should judge people not necessarily by the standards of their own time, but by the standards of all time. And I think in juxtaposing present and the past and drawing attention to things like medieval people weren't dirty by their standards, we also need to be able to say this slaver could pride himself on what he was doing and be a big man in the community, but by the standards that people knew at the time and were less well known and standards that we employ, this is an atrocity, an abomination. And if the lesson we learn from this is that we should not behave like this, then it's a good thing that we expose these people. So this duality of whose standards do you use to judge the past is much more complicated and much more interesting, and I think much more meaningful than most academic historians really recognize in their very studious approaches to the past.
That's fascinating. I mean, it's fascinating. Any student of history would agree on that. It's one of those questions, and I think that we, you know, it's strangely in a way with the Regency period, we do feel more justified in judging the people of this time. So, well, let's dive in, shall we? I mean, we always ask all our guests this question, so I will ask it to you. If you could travel back in time to any year, which year would it be?
Well, I've chosen 1825, but in my case, having written Time Traveller's Guides, where I literally have envisaged visiting virtually every year since 1300, I've got quite a lot that I really would quite like to see. But today we're going to talk about 1825 because it's a pretty damn good year.
It is a good, it is a really interesting year. And what is it about this year? I mean, we're kind of at towards the end, aren't we? We're towards the end of the Regency.
Towards the end of this Regency period, we're still looking at a period when the Ancien Régime is supported widely. The king is still all-powerful, pretty much. There is a lot of dissent in 1825. There was a bank failure. I mean, talk about 2008, wasn't it? You're looking at a very similar thing in 1825, massive crashing of banks around the country. So a lot of suffering, a lot of hardship, but the fear of a French Revolution style revolution in this country has gone away, so that the wealthy are now dressing in a much more flamboyant way than they had been. There is a great deal of style re-entering society, which had been a bit subdued in the 1790s and early 1800s. And so there is a real sense of panache about society.
Right. Is that Beau Brummel's influence there?
Enormously so. Yeah. Lord Byron said that there were three important people in Europe: Napoleon, Beau Brummel, and himself. In 1825, Byron's recently died. He died in Greece at Missolonghi the previous year. Beau Brummel is still alive at this point, but he exiled himself from England in 1816 on account of his debts. And he had definitely broken in a fantastic way from the Prince Regent a few years earlier. So there was no point in him being in London.
I mean, I think we should really talk about George IV, shouldn't we? Because he does kind of loom larger over this whole...
enormous character, physically as well as metaphorically, the Times obituary on him, which was published on the day after his funeral, I think is the most scathing obituary I have read on anybody
ever. It's shocking, isn't it?
It's amazing. No, I can't remember exact words off the top of my head, but you know, no creature was less lamented by his fellow men. If George IV ever had a true friend in any walk of life, the name has yet to reach us. What's more, it's really well written in its utter devastatingly damning report on the king. It's not like we just hate the man. It's very careful in the way it expresses an absolute absence of any virtue whatsoever, which is slightly unfair because he was the greatest patron of the arts the country had had on the throne since Charles I. And he does have that redeeming feature. But in some ways, you needed to be as spoilt and as self-interested as him in order to be able to be such a great patron of the arts.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, because he does, I mean, you know, if you look around, you know, he transformed Buckingham House into Buckingham Palace. I mean, he commissioned the crown worn by the Queen on all our coins and stamps today, I believe. I mean, you know, a huge investor in the arts, as you said. And I think In terms of the value that his investment in art, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's millions of pounds return in value now for every pound invested in the World Collection.
Oh gosh, yes, it would easily be that. I mean, the thing is that it could have been so much more as well, because, you know, things like Carlton House, it's magnificent. Mm. Well, the house itself was quite modest. He magnificently amplified the house and built really quite a striking palace, for want of a better word, on Pall Mall. And then in 1825, having made this the centrepiece of the connection from Regent's Park all the way down Regent Street to Carlton House and transformed the West End of London, he decided to knock it down. And the profligacy of the man.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I remember reading about his breakfasts. That always stuck with me as a schoolboy, actually. Just wondering how you even manage that in the morning. I can't remember what
waste,
it was.
Waste, basically. It's, yeah. you allow yourself to waste as much as you want. I mean, most of his meals, he'd be given the choice, like 14 dishes to pick from, which he would do with his friends, and there'd be huge waste, and there'd be another 14 at supper. Yeah, he ended up being colossally overweight and unhealthy towards the end of his life, a victim of his own self-indulgence. It's sad in many ways, but there was no one really to hold him in check.
No, of course, no. And of course, this was a time of great upheaval as well. It was a time of great poverty. I mean, there was, I think you mentioned in the book, there was never a period, perhaps until maybe modern times, really, where there was such a disparity in rich, between rich and poor.
Well, it depends how you... This is a really interesting question. This is something I'm going to return to in the future, because the question of inequality is a very interesting one and is obviously highly topical. Mm-hmm. So if you take groups of people and you compare the richest in terms of income, the wealthiest 1% by income, and compare them to the poorest 50% by income, the Regency was much more unequal than us. We are nowhere near as unequal as then, right. But it was more equal than the 17th century. If you go back to the pre-industrial period of late 17th century, the richest 1% by income have incomes on average roughly 33 times those of the lowest 50%. Right. If you come forward to Regency, it's about 26 times. Today, it's about 6.5 times. Right. So we are much more equal as groups now. Right. The difference today is the extremes. Because right. If you look at the very, 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 very richest, say the 10 richest people in the country in Regency times, they're worth in the region of sort of £2.5 to £3.5 million in total assets. Their incomes normally would be about 5% of that, so between £100,000 and £200,000, which compared to the £25 that the average labourer would make, is nowhere near the difference of the incomes of the 10 richest people today compared to the average working person today. So as groups, society as a bulk is much more even, but the absolute extremes are unprecedented in the modern world. You think society, well, it's got its rich, it's got its poor, it muddles along, but within that, there are huge changes, huge currents, and I'm amazed by it.
No, it's a fascinating topic. I think we are going to jump in straight away to our first scene, if you don't mind, because it's a really interesting one. So if you could take us to your first scene.
I'm going to start at the end of the year with 21st December 1825 and
okay.
The collapse of Fonthill Abbey.
Yes, this is really interesting. So yeah. What's actually happened here then?
Right, well, Fonthill Abbey is a house built by a plantation owner, basically somebody exploited the plantations, including slaves, a man called William Beckford. In the 1790s, he wrote to a friend of his saying, one of my plantation farms has turned up £7,000 more this year than I expected, so I'm going to be rich. He was. He was phenomenally rich. And therefore he built the most extraordinary, lavish, neo-Gothic, some would say monstrosity, at Fonthill in Wiltshire. And it's utterly massive. The central tower is something like 286 feet tall. The front door is 48 feet high. The hallway is 78 feet high. It's just the most staggering building. And I would love to see it on the 21st of December, but I want to get out before about midday.
Yes,
because right. That afternoon, the whole thing collapses and the central tower comes down.
This is incredible.
It destroys the house.
No warning? Just.
There was a storm. There were cracks. Beckford had been really lucky and sold the thing about 3 or 4 years earlier. And the owner then, a very rich man called John Farquhar, he was actually in one of the wingers of the house. And despite the fact this 286-foot column collapsed, taking down 3/4 of the whole house, he didn't notice.
Incredible. I couldn't believe that when I read that, how you could not notice something.
No, I mean, the engravings of the devastation, because this much masonry just collapsing like that.
What drove what drove him to build this house in the first place? I mean, it's beyond our, you know, it's beyond, I mean, beyond our comprehension, really. I mean, it's so huge. And then you write that he lived and dined alone.
Nelson had dinner with him once, but right. There are very few people who ever said they went to dinner with Beckford. He has got the most extraordinary imagination. I mean, he writes Gothic horror. Yes. He's the author of Vathek. His imagination is, you know, genuinely horrifying. He can write. He can imagine. He is original. He's not just a derivative dilettante. He's very well read. I mean, the three libraries in Fonthill Abbey. The imagination in creating the place is for the place where he is to be sensational. And I link this back to Byron again. There's a line from Byron: "The great object of life is to feel that we exist, even though in pain." And this, yeah, the sensation is what you're looking for, to feel that you exist, even though in pain. And Fonthill Abbey and its drama and its absolutely jaw-dropping proportions. I mean, when you get into the central octagon, I think the room there, I think the ceiling's something like 130 feet above you. It's jaw-dropping. So I think the idea is to create the sensations that correspond with Beckford's idea of drama and the neo-Gothic.
You describe it as a time when skyscrapers were tall ships.
Ships, yeah,
I love that idea.
That was a common name for tall ships, as a skyscraper.
It's quite absolutely lovely.
But yeah, I mean, the house was famous. People would pay a shilling to go along and be shown round, and you'd be shown these long galleries, like the Edward III Gallery, which was basically a long library. I mean, if you imagine something like the nave of Westminster Abbey lined with books, then you're looking at sort of, that's the sort of thing we're talking about. There was very much an abbey atmosphere to it. There's this sort of sense of pious learning and devotion to higher things that Beckford subscribed to. But at the end of one of these galleries, I think it was the end of the third gallery, you walked through opening glass doors. And I can remember reading that and thinking, that's the first time I have ever come across, in first period, yes, in which I've come across anybody talking about opening glass doors. So that really stuck in my mind. But the whole thing is just huge, vast, cavernous, freezing, devoted to his esoteric pursuits.
It's incredible, isn't it? I can only imagine watching that happen from afar. This was the period of great buildings being springing up across the country.
I think this is part of the fascination with Fonthill Abbey. I mean, it isn't there now. There's a tiny fragment of it, which is just, you don't get any idea of what Fonthill was like from seeing this tiny fragment. But there is a tiny bit still standing. You need to look at the guidebook from 1822, A New Guide to Fonthill Abbey. And you need to look at the etching of after it collapsed and see the devastation. And also some of the scenes from the time showing how much it dominated the countryside for miles around. But we have another extraordinary building in Brighton that we all know and some of us love, in Brighton Pavilion.
Yes.
And you look at that and you think, Jesus Christ, what was the Prince Regent trying to achieve there? And then you think, well, this is part of his extraordinary vision for architecture and art, the other part being Carlton House, which has been destroyed.
Right.
And both of those are not a patch on Fonthill. That's the amazing thing about Fonthill. When you look today at the survivor of these remarkable buildings, Brighton Pavilion and a few others around the country, you have to reflect that these are the pale shadows of the most extraordinary domestic building of the age.
It must have been incredible. It must have been absolutely beautiful.
I'd love to have a party there. Yeah. I'd do far better at hosting parties than William Beckford, I'm pretty sure of
You'd
that.
You'd need a lot of friends, wouldn't you? I mean,
I'm prepared to ask a few friends to bring their friends along too.
Yeah, yeah.
And let's face it, if you've got Beckford's fortune, you could say free booze.
Yeah, so, absolutely. Oh, fantastic. That's brilliant. Lovely. So moving along, we'll take go to our next scene. So scene two, where are we off to next?
We are going back a few months to 27th of September, 1825.
Right, right. And where are we and what's happening?
We're going to be at the opening of the Stockton to Darlington Railway.
Right.
Now, this is a subject which I'm particularly interested to see simply because it is such an important milestone in what loosely we could call the progress of technology.
Yes.
It is the opening of the first public railway in the world.
Yes.
And it is the first day on which a locomotion, a steam locomotive, pulls along passengers in a passenger carriage along rails. And it's therefore an enormously important event in the history of the world.
Mm.
And I've never been to Stockton or Darlington, but I imagine going there on that day and seeing the excitement and yet knowing what that event's going to come to mean to the rest of the world within a very short period of time would be very poignant.
Yeah, this is the moment where human beings step onto the machine. It's
in a big way. Mm. I mean,
the world changes forever from this point. We're
absolutely, you know. And I think yes, the world changes forever, as you say. If you think about the Industrial Revolution in its broader sense, going from, let's say, 1740 through to 1850, 1860, got 120 years of huge change, obviously. But the drivers throughout that are largely economic. People want to make wealthy, so they're never going to be hungry. That's the whole general premise. If farmers in the agricultural revolution, which is the early 18th century, can create enough food that if you've got enough money, you will never go hungry, then people want to create more money. And once they have the drive to make more money, they want to make more money and more money. And therefore, the drive towards buying things and having things and showing off your status through what you own takes over.
Mm.
But none of that really needed to have changed the world in itself, except for our ability to move around. Because until the railways come along, well, apart from a very few specific instances of the military and wartime using semaphores, news travels as fast as somebody can ride a horse.
Mm.
And people can't travel very far because it's just too expensive to do so. So if you're riding, I mean, the standard legal distance for riding every day was 20 miles, although people could ride more than that. You know, that's more or less year in, year out, season in, season out, what people did. It was 20 miles a day. And it cost, of course, to travel that and stay somewhere at an inn and food and all that, and to tip people, of course. So not many people could travel very far from home. And if they did, it was a big occasion. They didn't often do it.
Mm.
So place has a much greater importance in the pre-railway era, so that small towns, which we wouldn't call towns today, I mean, where I live here in Moreton Hampstead, in Devon, there's about 1,000 people living in this town, and in the early 19th century, there were about 2,000 people living in the whole parish, so it's more or less the same size. And yet this was a focal centre for miles around for people to get their food, to buy clothes, to go to the doctor, etc. So place has so much more importance before you can travel so easily. And as you say, the world changed forever.
Yeah, I mean, it just really did, didn't it? I mean, it's hard to think of anything, when we think about the mass movement of humanity today and the way it's changed the world. This is when you really think about this, one day in sort of, Stockton to Darlington Railway. It really does kind of give you pause for thought, really, and think, wow. It kind of reminds me a bit of, you were saying earlier in one part of the book how people walked, and before this, some people would walk pretty long, what we consider now, you know, quite extreme distances to you know, from London back up to the north of England.
Oh, the very long distance walking. I mean, I was surprised how common that was.
Yeah.
I mean, I was aware, and always have been aware, that it was usual to walk sort of 15, 20 miles a day for the people who didn't want to maintain a horse.
Yes.
But as you allude to, and I draw attention in the book, some people walked enormous distances. Yeah. I mean, walking from Scotland to go to Parliament.
I mean, it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, if you were to say, I'm just going to walk, I'm going to walk, how are you going up to Manchester? I'm going to, you know, from London.
Oh, walking,
I'm going to walking. People now would think, it's a bit like how quickly we adapt to these things, isn't it? Because like nowadays, I mean, with smartphones, for example, it's more or less like we've gone in the space of a few years from nobody having one to being considered slightly odd if you don't.
You are
congratulations on that.
But here we come back to the French Revolution again, because it's French Revolution that sets off this idea that everything in the modern world has seen more change, every period of the modern world has seen more change than everything else.
Yes.
And it's only since 1789 we thought this way, but these days everybody thinks the modern age is changing more than ever because of technology.
Right. Absolutely. But I think you're right in that, you know, the moment we're talking about at the moment. Sorry,
27th of September 1825.
Yeah, this is kind of it's momentous, because if you think about the influence that this basically proving that you can move people around using machinery, it just changed everything. And you know, when we talk about the mass flow of humanity around the planet, this is where it all began, really. And
absolutely,
it would have been do we know what it was the day, I mean, who boarded the train? Was it a big event?
I think it was quite a big event, right. I think there was quite a razzmatazz about it. George and Robert Stevenson, the engineers of the line, and the locomotion number one, which was the locomotive in question, which I believe still survives, they would have made sure that the publicity was amplified and as many people as possible would have been involved. I mean, it didn't become a regular passenger service, I have to add that. The first regular passenger services opened up in 1830 to Canterbury and Whitstable, and in Manchester and Liverpool. Right. So those two date from 1830. So this is a pioneer event. But in many ways, I'd have liked to ask whoever was on that train, you know, how do you imagine this is going to change things in the future? Because it really would test your imagination. If you have a display of something as momentous and as powerful as that to change the world, how far can you imagine change? How far can you dream of change? In fact, how far can you dream, full stop? It's a question I often ask people. I mean, that to be in that position of being on that train and thinking, what do you think the limits of the implications of this are? And think 20 years ahead, 30 years ahead. Can you think 40 years ahead? I mean, amazing.
I wonder what they would have thought. Yeah, they looked ahead and seen all these commuters standing on platforms at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Well, they've seen that. I mean, where I am here, we used to have a train from 1866, so 41 years after this, the Moreton Hampstead and edge of Dartmoor got a branch line going down to Newton Abbot. And as so often certainly in the West Country, the train acts as like as a sort of straw to suck people out into the bigger towns.
Yes.
And I normally find this in socioeconomic history, that when you have better connections open up, they tend to benefit the bigger place and suck life out of the smaller one, which is why I'm a bit worried about HS2 going ahead. But but to concentrate on 1825, it was the beginning of the end for so many market towns.
Hello, it's Artemis, one of the presenters on this podcast. You'll know that we've been working with the visual historian Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph over the last few months to bring moments from our episodes to life, whether it's shots of the Beatles in 1964 or Oscar Wilde in 1882. Well, these wonderful colourised historical images and many more are available for purchase as museum-grade, archive-quality art prints at colourgraph.co. They make unusual, compelling, and just really cool Christmas presents for that history fan in your life. And what's more, a selection of some of the very best prints are now available in a smaller size and for a smaller price. So for just £23, or $30, you can get a fascinating image of the Titanic, or Mark Twain, Fidel Castro, or Abraham Lincoln. Check out the full range at colourgraph.co. And remember, if you add the code TTT at the checkout, you get an extra 10% off.
And I suppose we're on to one I'm particularly looking forward to now, which is your final scene. I was wondering if you could let us know where we're going next.
Right, we're going to the Argyle Rooms in Regent Street, London, and it's going to be the late afternoon, early evening of the 21st of March, 1825, because there's a rather special concert planned. And there's a bit of a background to this. England's full of music. Absolutely. I mean, every walk of life you find there's music going on. But we don't, in this period, produce any great composers of our own. A number come here. There's a violinist who goes to Vienna in 1790, and he wants to bring Haydn to London. And he knocks on Haydn's door and says, "Hello, my name is Salomon from London, and I've come to fetch you." And I just love that as an introduction to this great composer. And Haydn must have been totally bloody bewildered. I mean, what do you make of this? But he came. He was well paid for his year or so in London. He wrote six symphonies here and enjoyed himself so much he came back again two or three years later. But apart from that, there isn't a great engagement with the leading composers, because we're a bit on the periphery of Europe, to be honest, and there aren't any great composers here. So the Philharmonic Society is set up in London to try and remedy this and trying to bring people here. And they succeed in bringing composers like Spohr, and who's also a violinist, and Cherubini, and people like that to London, and they come and conduct performances. And by the 1820s, Mozart's long dead and Haydn's long dead, and there is only one of the great composers who might come to London, and that is Ludwig van Beethoven. By 1817, when they first try and commission a piece, they offer Beethoven £300 if he'll come here and conduct two symphonies. He refuses. And this carries on. They keep on asking and asking and asking. And I think it's in 1822, there's another minute from the Philharmonic Society offering £50 for Beethoven if you'll just send them a symphony, please. Because his music is more appreciated here than that of any other composer.
Right.
And by this stage, on Monday evenings, they are having these monthly concerts in the Argyle Rooms for the first 6 months of the year. And they're hugely popular. And it always features work from Mozart, one work from Beethoven, one work from Haydn, and plenty of other things. And I think it's 1822, they get a letter from Beethoven saying, yes, he will give them a symphony.
Right.
And they have to wait for it, and he doesn't actually come. But on the 27th of April, 1824, their agent in Vienna is handed the manuscript of his Ninth Symphony. And I think it just, God, that moment. You've commissioned Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. They don't get to do the premiere because politics intervene, and it's insisted that Beethoven's great work should be first performed in Vienna. You know, if you're going to allow me a little excursion back to 1824, I'd definitely go to the 7th of May 1824 performance in Vienna when Beethoven was there in person, and the very, very famous moments when there's absolute rapture in the place. I mean, the reviews are extraordinary. Just as the obituary of George IV is probably the worst obituary ever written, the reviews of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony in Vienna on the 7th of May are amongst the best reviews ever written. And Beethoven can't hear any of it. He can't hear a damn thing. And Fräulein Unger, the soprano on the occasion, realises he doesn't know what's happening. So she walks over to him and takes him by the shoulders and just turns him around so he can see the audience applauding. Wow. And I'd love to have been there that day. But we're in 1825.
But we are,
and
yes.
best I can do is to queue up with everybody else.
Outside the Argyle Rooms.
Argyle Rooms on 21st of March for the first English performance.
And where can the Argyle Rooms, they're on Regent Street.
I mean, if you're walking up Regent Street, you go around the quadrant, which is the bend at the bottom.
Yeah.
And then you walk up towards Oxford Circus, and a little bit south of Oxford Circus on the right-hand side was the place where the Argyle Room stood. And there is a plaque there to say that is where the first performance was, on the side of a shop.
So the Argyle, I mean, how big was it? Do we know how many people would have attended?
I did look into that. I don't know off the top of my head. I found drawings and etchings of what it looked like. There's drawings of the inside as well as the outside. We're not talking about something the size of the Drury Lane Theatre.
Right.
We're not talking about something that can seat 3,000 people. The size of a large provincial theatre, so around 600 is what I'm thinking would have been there that occasion.
Right.
Now, on the day itself, it didn't all go according to plan, and people were apprehensive. Sir George Smart, the conductor, although he was a very capable man and knew what he was doing. He had the manuscript for quite a long time. And in his words, I can just about get a grasp of it. And in order to get a grasp of it, he had actually been to Vienna to talk to Beethoven about how he is going to perform this, this concert. But even though he'd spoken to the man himself, he still wasn't wholly confident. Because in London, the whole Italian opera, the popularity of Italian opera meant that choral music had to be sung in Italian. Mm-hmm. There was the idea, we're not going to sing this in German, we're going to sing it in Italian, which I think everybody reckons now is a big mistake.
Yes.
So there's problems of language, there are problems that people just aren't used to a symphony that's over an hour long, mm-hmm. normally performed over an hour long. The extraordinarily high notes the soprano has to sing weren't a help. And the reviews are all damning. Absolutely
yes,
damning.
They are, aren't they? I've got one here, as it says, we must express our hope that this new work of the great Beethoven may be put into a more producible form and that the repetitions may be omitted and the chorus removed altogether.
The chorus removed altogether.
That is unbelievable.
And yet I would love to have gone there, because I would like to have been sitting alongside the people who commissioned it and say, do you realise you have commissioned what will be the world's favourite piece of music for the next 200 years. There will be listened thousands, as long as people have ears, they'll be listened to Beethoven's Ninth. And throughout the world, no matter which continent, which culture, it is the anthem of the free man. When tranks were rolling in Tiananmen Square in China in the late 80s, they played Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Pinochet prisoners listened to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony being played over the walls of their prisons at them. I mean, wherever you are in the world, that tune, that song and everything it stands for is the song of the free man and woman.
It must have been incredible.
I just think, just to say, good on you.
I mean, I agree. And I think one of the things that strikes me about it is this idea that when you would turn up to listen to that, you've got no... we're so in our modern world, we're so used to having music at our fingertips, aren't we? We can listen to this. We can listen to Beethoven anytime we like, or we can, and to be in that position where you'd walk into a theatre, an auditorium, and you'd sit down and you'd hear this sound, and you'd never have heard anything like that really. And you know, just to be the scale of it and the complexity and the how these musicians were playing, and then you leave and all you have really is a memory of it. You can't go home and you can't buy the CD in the foyer on the way home, on the way out.
No, then the second performance was until 26th of April 1830. So
it's incredible.
Yeah, you had to wait 5 years for the
it's an experience I guess we'll never get to have, really.
This is true. But most of what I deal with is trying my best to imagine experiences I never actually be able to have all the way through the past. This is my job, is actually imagining going to the past all the time.
And brilliant. And finally, Ian, if you could just, we always ask our guests if they could bring back a memento from this year, what would it be?
It would be Byron's Skullcap.
Right.
Now, Lord Byron inherited Newstead Abbey, which is a wonderful pile in Nottinghamshire, a house created out of the cloister and part of the church of a medieval abbey. And in the grounds, he came across the skull of a monk, which he had cut in half and fashioned into a cup. Right. And on that cup, he had a poem inscribed in six stanzas, but it begins something like, "Start not, nor deem my spirit fled. In me behold the only skull from which, unlike a living head, whatever flows is never dull." And I just love the idea of this treasured icon. There is a drawing of it. The original doesn't survive, as far as I know. There is a drawing of it. And since Byron had actually sadly expired the previous year, at the age of 36, as a boy, he was one of my heroes, probably is sort of my literary hero growing up. But I'm 53 now. It's very difficult to have a literary hero who's younger than you. And I've got a problem now that Shakespeare's died younger than I am now. I'm going to go for the skull cup of Lord Byron, wherever it may.
It would be amazing. And you, as you say, it's no one knows where it is now.
I imagine that some pious Victorian owner decided it was best to bury it somewhere.
Yeah.
But if I'm wrong, I'd be delighted to know, and I would love to see it if it exists still.
It would be fantastic, wouldn't it? Those pesky Victorians ruining everyone's fun.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. It was a wonderful talking to you. I mean, do you have any plans with the Time Traveller series to venture into the Victorian era? Or
I'm not going to go into the Victorian era. The the bigger society gets, and we're talking about massively a huge society in Victorian times, the difficult it is to encapsulate it in a simple way.
Right.
The harder it is to surprise people, the more used you are to it. I mean, if you read A Time Traveller's Guide to Yesterday, you wouldn't be very impressed, would you?
Mm.
So there's not enough surprise, there isn't enough contrast with the modern world. So I don't think there's a lot of point in coming much further forward. And frankly, when most of my skills are in the period 1250 through to 1750, I'm going to be find it harder and harder to write that period. So I do have plans for the Time Travellers series,
right,
and I'm not going to venture onto areas that I don't know. So, but I do have an idea how I can do something differently, and it will surprise everybody when it comes along.
Oh, well, we look forward to that. That was something to look to.
It'll be very, very different from the first four, I have to say.
Ah, excellent.
But don't hold your breath, because it's certainly not going to be in the next 3 years.
Okay, there's a lot of work to be done yet. So.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay. Well, Ian, thanks again. Thank you very much. And, you know, it was a really good fun reading the book. So it's The Time Traveller's Guide to Regency Britain. And that's published by Random House. And it's available now. And thank you so much. And the best of luck with the Time Traveller series in the future.
Thank you very much. It was cracking fun. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
That was John Hillman speaking to Ian Mortimer about the year 1825. Ian's book, The Time Traveller's Guide to Regency Britain, is published by The Bodleyhead and is available to buy now. Thanks so much for listening. Goodbye.